champion becomes a legend. Mackay Beaver has won it.
Perkins goes in first. What a legend. What a champion.
Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
As always, a pleasure to have your company for This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And today we celebrate the life of a man who certainly made his mark on the racing industry here in Victoria and indeed around Australia. Almost 2,400 winners. And of course, he trained one of the greatest horses of all time. Her name was Black Caviar. His name is Peter Moody, and he's in the studio with me. Pete, welcome.
Great to be here, Pete.
We go back a little while. I was just trying to recall the first time I met you was probably after Amalfi won the Derby.
Yeah, that was my first feature winner, and a nice way to sort of announce my arrival in Victoria.
We'll talk about that particular Derby, but when you win a race like that at that carnival, how much does it do for your profile as a trainer, and how much does it get people who previously weren't aware of you interested in what you might be able to do?
Oh, it's, you know, does endless amounts for your business for sure as a young racehorse trainer. At the time, I was still based in Queensland, and I'd just opened a satellite stable in Victoria probably about 6 months previous to that. And that was off the back of sort of good clientele in Queensland and New South Wales, but I had very little interest in Victoria. So I had to have a bit of luck quickly, otherwise it was going to be a fading shadow. I came down in mid-2001. A mate of mine, Jim Conlon, had just moved from Caulfield down to Cape Schanck, and his stables at Caulfield became available, and the VATC, I think it was at the time, gave me permission to train there, and Racing Victoria gave me a licence, and we set up base, and, 6 months into that, it was very important to hit the ground running.
You trained for so long at Caulfield. It seems as though the racing industry is now getting away from training at the big training centres and everybody's getting their own property if it's possible. Do you think that's the way the English model will eventually take over racing?
I think it's just a real estate situation as much as anything. You see the inner city tracks Australia-wide these days. We saw it in South Australia where they lost the old Vic Park and then Cheltenham, and in Queensland, I was sort of domiciled in that Hendra area around Doomben and Eagle Farm for my early stage of my career, and all the stables off course are now on course, and all the big old stable blocks of Bruce McLaughlin and Roy Dawson and all that are all housing or apartment blocks. Randwick, similar, although they've always had the on-course stabling. The off-course stabling's all gone now, and used to be sort of stables all around the streets of Randwick and Kensington and even across to Rosebery, where long before my time there used to be a racetrack and horses used to float into Randwick. So it's just a natural progression. And I suppose Caulfield, that real estate around Caulfield, I think Caulfield's a bit of a unique situation. I believe everything inside the everything outside the course proper to the streets is Melbourne Racing Club, and I stand to be corrected, and I believe the infield is Crown Land, so it's got to be made accessible to people, and that land's just become too valuable, I suppose. It's got to be used, and the community's built up that much. It's a shame. Like, you lose a lot of history. Like, when I first went there into Jim Conlon Stables, I was off course behind the members' car park and those old cobblestone laneways that are still there, but all the stables are now apartment blocks, so... I think we're such a vast country. We've got so much room, but the upkeep of those private facilities is massive, you know. So I think the racing industry need to get on the front foot and provide first-class facilities. We've seen Ballarat really develop in the last 5 or 6 years off the back of Darren Weir's success. Pakenham's being developed at the moment. Cranbourne has been an ongoing project ever since I've been in Victoria. I think it's just a natural thing, and unfortunately for the inner city people to pop over to Caulfield or Flemington and watch their horse have a trial or a gallop in the morning, it's probably going to be a bygone era soon.
Something about that clip-clop that you used to hear in Leonard Crescent and around the streets of Caulfield before track work in the morning, it's like a soundtrack to racing, isn't it, of days gone by?
Yeah, for sure. And it's amazing how people don't respect or realise the area. I was just listening to another radio station late last week, and a lady near the South Melbourne Town Hall complained about the clock that's been ringing since 1880 on the hour, every hour from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m.
Really?
And, you know, it's a bit like a person moving into Caulfield and complaining about the smell of horse poo and flies.
Yeah.
You know, what did they expect? You know, this has been going on there for probably 200 years. And that's something I went through quite a lot of when I was domiciled at Caulfield, complaints and that of the neighbours. And then there's been community groups that have really worked hard against the training of horses there. But it's been, like you say, a fabric of society there for hundreds of years. And it is coming to a close, I think, sadly, too.
How do you reckon racing's going at the moment?
Oh, I think it's in a good spot. You've got $500 million, $500 million in prize money between Victoria and New South Wales alone. That's mammoth. So the possibility of return to the investor that hasn't been there for probably the last couple of hundred years is really gone ahead. Listen, we've hit a few curveballs, and I've been one of those myself. Mm. You know, we've hit a few bumps in the roads and a few speed humps. But it's a very forgiving industry, and because it's a gaming industry, you know, people quite often frown upon it. People remove from it, which is sad. You know, it's one of the largest industries in this country, the equine industry. I think third or fourth largest in the country. So that's phenomenal. And the return to the community, not only in this city, but Australia-wide, rural, provincial, whatever, is mammoth. So it doesn't get a lot of the respect it deserves, but because it's a gaming industry, unfortunately a lot of people frown upon it, and they really highlight the negatives. And there's so many positives out there and so many wonderful stories, you know.
Yeah, and the one thing that I say when people talk to me about racing and some of the things that attract those headlines that you're talking about is the genuine love of the animal that I saw in my time going to stables and talking to trainers and jockeys. That shone through to me, and I don't know how you could be associated in a sport like this if you didn't have that love for the animal.
No, that's right. It's, you know, you don't get out of bed for minimum wage at 2:33 a.m. in the middle of winter, pick up horse manure and feed and water them without having the love of the horse, you know. And I know myself, it was a business for me, and I had to run it as a business, and it was a big business and a business that was very good to me. But the reason I became involved in it and the reason I believe I succeeded in it so well is I think I had a genuine love of the horse, and I still do. I still really share that, and I'm still very much involved for that reason and that reason alone.
Do you miss the hands-on aspect of what you used to do, though? Because your role has changed, and you were very much the boss, and you were calling the shots, and you were hands-on. Is that something you miss?
Yeah, well, it's always hard from going, you know, you're top dog, and then you're having to answer to other people and you know, seek their approval to do things, and I sort of do a bit of consultancy now, a bit of a consultant role with a few organisations, namely Rosemont Stud, based down at Narwari and near Geelong, and Wiley Dalziel, a syndicator here in Victoria, and I still do a fair bit for some private clients as well, and just go and seek their approval to do things. It's unusual for me, and something that took a lot of getting used to, where I used to have a committee meeting of one.
Yeah.
Made the decision. If it was the right one, I'd pat myself on the back. If it was the wrong one, I'd try and find someone else to blame, like anyone else.
So, learned that from jockeys over the years, did you?
Exactly. So it is an unusual turn of events for me, but I'm still very involved. But I really miss the competitiveness, probably on race day, of being a trainer. Like in my role in the media now with racing.com and Ladbrokes and that, I attend a lot of race meetings and to see the boys there saddling up one in a good race, or even a maiden at Bairnsdale, it doesn't worry me. The competitiveness of getting a horse ready and the craft and the artiness, if you like, I do miss that. Now I drop my horses off that I own myself or I manage or consult with at other trainers' doors and then wait for them to call me and let me know what's going on instead of being in the engine room. And that's the bit. And the camaraderie between the trainers, at Caulfield especially, we had a great close-knit group of trainers and good blokes, and you could bounce off one another. And I think, you know, it was special, and I miss that.
Yeah, I've been part of some of those early morning training sessions, and I often thought, gee, it might be a good idea to record this, but you could never put it to air.
No, you'd probably end up in an asylum or a jail or a cemetery.
In that order.
Yes.
What about your time in the media? Well, I spoke about 2001 meeting you, and I think probably you were not the most comfortable guy in front of the camera. Would that be fair enough to say? But that's changed a lot.
Yeah, well, I've always had a good relationship with the media, and I've always worked closely and well with them, I think. Probably a bit of new kid in town back when you first met me, but even in Queensland, I noted how important the media were to broadcasting the right message about the success you're having and trying to grow your stable, and I always tried to make myself accessible to the media for that and work hard with them because it's very important. They put the message out there in front of people, and you know, you could go somewhere and train a handful of winners and no one know about it if the media weren't on side as such, you know, or you could train one winner totally left field, and as long as you had the right media person's ear, it was front and centre, and that got promoted. And for me, coming from Queensland to Victoria, it was not only a mammoth step for myself and my family, but business. I did it on the back of I trained for some very good breeders in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, and predominantly most of my clients were in Queensland, and I knew they were prepared to support me for a certain degree, but I know people like to be around where their horses are racing, so I had to quickly, you know, develop a Victorian clientele. Because even though the day I stopped training, you know, nearly 3 years ago to the day as we sit here, I still train for a lot of my original owners, but the backbone of my stable were Victorian clientele that came on board. So I had to make sure, you know, I didn't have the ability to promote myself, so I had to use the media that were available to me, and I made sure I had a good working relationship with them, an honest working relationship with them, and, you know, it served me very well, probably until the last short time in my career.
Yeah. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. Did you find the transition into the media a fairly easy one? Because I can stand there all day and talk to Chris Waller about his horses. But if you talk to Chris Waller, there's that empathy between the two of you, especially with those two great horses that you've had. And that brings an answer that I possibly could never get from him.
Well, it probably is easier for me to deal with racing folk, because I know what they're going through. I know when they need to be left alone. I know when they're probably happy to have a chat. And I did a bit with Channel 7 the last few years in the autumn carnivals, and that was around Winks and that, and they asked me to do a few things with Chris, and I said, no. You know, I know, listen, he's going to try and oblige you, but he's not going to be wanting to do it because, you know, he's got other things or this on his mind or that on his mind. And then they'd put forward another suggestion and say, yeah, that's a good idea because he's probably going to be able to do that. So I've probably been able to aid some of the media outlets that I've helped with that bit of insight knowledge and to be able to have a chat to them. And, you know, has it been easy? Do I enjoy it? It allows me to get close to the good horses on good days because I pretty much only partake during the carnivals, and you get the best seat in the house. And it really surprised me how quickly it's flowed. Like, if I went to the races as a racehorse trainer and had a runner in race 1 and 5, I'd go and sit in my car for 2 or 3 races and read a book or read the form guide. It's amazing how quickly it turns over. You have a chat pre and post race and walk out the back and have a bunger and a leak, and the next horses are in the yard. So it's amazing for me how quickly it's gone. And I have enjoyed it. I really have. And I hope I've done a fair job. I've been invited back to most media outlets that have given me a little bit of work. So I must be doing more right than wrong. And it's been great working with different personalities in the media and learning about them and off them and the knowledge. You know, someone like Bruce McAvaney, you know, his knowledge is unparalleled in all sports. You know, many other commentators and blokes, you can sit back and sort of learn off them. And the old adage, you know, you're never too old to learn, eyes and ears open, mouth shut.
Did it come at a good time for you, that opportunity? Because it would have been easy to be bitter about the whole experience. Do you carry any bitterness about what happened?
I do. I'd be lying if I said otherwise. But funny thing, my wife probably put a point to me as much as anything. You know, you can go and lock yourself in a dark room and stay away from every bugger. But I honestly believe I did nothing wrong. I felt hard done by, and I felt a lot in the industry let me down. I wasn't looking for a free hit, but I was looking for a bit of understanding. And unfortunately, the cobalt crisis that brought about my undoing still being played out today, and I find that to be very unfortunate for the people that are tied up in it. And I think more importantly, the officials know more about it than the trainers that they've pinged for it, me included. So one thing my wife said, you know, you always prided yourself on you know, if someone, you know, the best way to front someone you don't like is run up and shake their hand and give their wife a kiss and pat their kids on the head, because you know that's going to hurt the bastards more than turning and running the other way. So my theory towards officials of the racing, when I did have a few opportunities to work in the media, not mainstream racing media, because there's no doubt there's a black man on me there. I did have approaches to do it in the very early days, but I know the people that wanted me there weren't allowed to employ me. I thought when the opportunity rose, if I could sit there under those officials' noses and you know, do a good job, I reckon that'd hurt them more if they never saw me again. So that was my little niggle in the side. But listen, we've got to build a bridge and move on. It's not the Sydney Harbour Bridge, the one I've built. It's probably a rickety old bamboo bastard up in Papua New Guinea somewhere. But for the sake of my sanity and the people around me and the support of my family and all that, I've got to get on with life.
One last question about this, because I don't want to dwell on it. There's so much more that we've got to talk about with your career. But did friendships break at that time? And if they did, have you been able to repair those?
I think a lot of people at the time, and even the odd one now, still that I train beside, were very sceptical. You know, we've got the bastard, that's why he was going so well, this and that. But I think as people have learned about this Cobalt saga as it's gone on, I think people probably have a lot more understanding for what I went through. And, you know, at the time I know people turned their backs on me and walked away, and I know a lot of people basically put a lot of shit on, to be honest. And blokes that I had respect for, and some of them great trainers and people I had great admiration for, I still respect their careers and what they've achieved, but don't respect them as people. But that's a part of life, and every walk of life in it, you learn who your mates are. And I was lucky that I was surrounded by a strong, solid family and a good group of core friends. And 90% of the blokes at Caulfield that I worked beside understood what I was going through. So we got on with life. You know, there was dark times, I'd be lying.
How dark?
Never anything to thinking doing anything silly, but, I pulled up beside the Monash Freeway and Wellington Road with my hands and my knees crying like a baby at times, thinking, why me? You know, what have I done to deserve this? You know, why are racing so hell-bent on destroying what I thought was a good, successful career? And I worked, I believe, very hard to promote racing in a positive light. And they just would not have a bar of, at the time, any sort of meeting, finding any middle ground. So not only could I get on with my life, but racing could, because it was, you know, at the time, and there's been probably a couple of scandals since, but at the time it was probably one of the biggest scandals in racing. And a stable of the magnitude of mine had never been closed, at that point ever. But they just didn't want a bar of it, you know, and we've since learnt, you know, the days of me being on the front page of the Herald Sun with a syringe in my hand injecting, had to give this horse Cobalt on the day at race to get these levels. Now we find out that the slightest thing can lift their levels, and unfortunately, you know, innocent people are getting caught up in it without not having any understanding of it. You know, I think there's some 200 unresolved Cobalt cases in the three codes of racing in Australia. And unfortunately, I think for those people out there that have them, if it wasn't for the likes of maybe Peter Moody or maybe a Denny O'Brien or Mark Kavner, the fear that authorities might have or the legal ramifications that authorities might have if they threw the rule in the bin where it duly arrives, the ramifications that could come about some of us taking action against them, I've pretty much resolved myself that that'll never happen. If someone walked up to me and said, listen, we're going to get rid of this rule, we're happy to give you the legal fees that it cost you, I'd probably happily walk away. But that's never going to happen. And unfortunately, the people with these unresolved cases are going to have to go through a bullshit scenario like I did.
Let's leave it at that, because, yeah, as I said, 2,399 winners. Mm. There are a lot of good things to talk about.
For sure.
And we'll do that on the other side of the break with Peter Moody, my guest on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. More with Pete coming up after the break.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
What a pleasure it is to have Peter Moody as my guest on This Is Your Sporting Life. Pete, Where did it all begin? The boy from Queensland, where did your love of horses begin?
I grew up on a cattle and sheep property in Western Queensland, Wyandra, between Charlevoix and Cunnamulla, far southwest, and family always had an interest in racing. My family was like most in the bush when the seasons were good and cattle prices and wool prices were good. You know, the family used to race horses with the local racehorse trainers. When there was a drought or bad season, those horses were used for stockwork. So always had a love of them. And my parents divorced when I was quite young and I moved into town. And with my horse background, pony clubs and shows and gymkhanas and all that, it sort of led to a natural attraction of racehorses and thoroughbreds and sort of basically instantly fell in love. You know, I was probably 10 or 11, 12 at the time. And, you know, we used to travel vast distances out there for everything, but racing, you know, it's nothing unusual to go 200 or 300 kilometres or mile even for a race meeting on a Saturday and get home at midnight and get on the footy bus Sunday morning and go the same distance in another direction for a game of footy in the winter or cricket in the summer. And it's just a part of life. But I had the opportunity to go down and work for Tommy Smith when I was 15 through a great mate of mine, Brett Kavanagh, who trains up at Scone now, and he was a big part of my success down here. Brett used to do all my breaking and educating of horses, firstly at Togemoor and then at Albury. And Brett's stepfather, John Drennan, was Tommy Smith's horsebreaker, so they arranged for me to go down there as a 15-year-old, and I can still remember that first morning getting off the McCafferty's bus at Darlinghurst and getting the cab to Todman Avenue, Barrel Street, between Barrel and Todman Avenue. It was a Tullock Lodge, and settling in there and walking over and having a look at the Renwick Racecourse and, you know, the expanse of the place and everything. It was just, you know, this was my career. This was what I was going to do by hook or by crook. And
what was your first meeting like with TJ?
Oh, listen, TJ had a great affinity for kids from the bush, I think. You know, you probably didn't have as many bad habits as a few of the other older boys. And but it was a great learning curve. You know, I created friendships in those first few years at TJ's that I still hold through today, which I'm very proud of. And blokes that are still strappers and work riders and, you know, mightn't have wanted to go on and be trainers, or whether bad luck or bad judgment cut them back. But I still love getting up to Sydney and getting to the Doncaster Hotel at Randwick or few of the other pubs around the area, and there's always someone there you work with, and I really pride myself on the fact that I can sit down and have a beer with those boys still to this day that I kicked off with back then, you know. And it was, you know, I think, you know, I was a big sort of, you know, laid back lout from the bush, and, you know, I had plenty of opportunity to develop bad habits, but I didn't, and I think people respected me for that. And you know, I had a good work ethic with my upbringing, and it sent me on my way. I spent about 3 years on and off with TJ, and then I went home when I was 18, knew everything. I was going to train in the bush. And
you do when you're 18, don't you?
Yeah, and that's 6 foot tall and bulletproof, but I quickly, you know, I missed that growing up stage too, you know, growing up with my mates in the bush and playing footy and cricket and chasing sheilas, drinking grog and probably smoking pot and everything else you did when you were 18 back then in the bloody 80s.
Speak for yourself.
Oh, well, you'd probably outgrown that by then. You were in the 70s. You were probably a flower power child belting around Australia in a combi van.
Yeah, right. Okay, come on. This is about you, not about me.
So we won't go there, right? So I went home for a brief period and quickly realised that my future lay, you know, metropolitan racing. And I had an associate that put me in contact with a young trainer at the time called Bill Mitchell. He'd just moved to Randwick and he had a few handy horses, and went down and worked with Bill and had a great, you know, it was a fantastic 10 years, basically 10 years to the day. I think it was 89 to 99, Bill and I, 5 years in Sydney and 5 years I ran his satellite stable in Queensland, where we're sort of a bit of a forerunner for training partnerships. We applied for a training partnership back then in the mid-90s and with the Queensland Turf Club, and obviously they knocked it back because they weren't the done thing then, but we had a business relationship that grew, and that allowed me to develop my own business, my own skills, and I managed and trained and looked after the horses in Queensland, and Bill continued on with his Randwick stable, and we had good success, and part of that success was a very good sprinter called General Nadim.
Mm.
And he was probably the horse that enabled me to showcase my talents, and credit to Bill, he never ever held it back. You know, he always, you know, gave me a pat on the back because Bill was the licensed trainer, but he always recognised that I'd worked with the horse and had him his sort of most of his career in Brisbane, and we won the Magic. I think we won 12 out of 16 with him, and we brought him down to Melbourne, won a Lightning Stakes in a Newmarket, and I travelled down with horses with Bill over the years to Victoria, but that was the sort of first time that I came down here, you know, with a horse of that calibre and to win those sort of races. You know, previously we'd come down and won a Carbine Club and a few mares races with a few fillies and that we had in Bill's stable. Stylish Century, but that was a bit of a circus. And we had a great old horse called Liverstone Elaine and another good horse called From the Planet, but they were unfortunately had a lot of issues. But General Nadeem arrived in town, you know, and I think he ran the Lightning and, you know, he's a short price favourite. He ran last in an Oakley Plate, and then we were able to bounce back and win a Newmarket Handicap, beating Scandinavia, who ended up being the Grand Dam of Black Caviar, a very short margin. And at that time, I thought, well, I will never, ever work with a horse this fast again. Little did I know that the horse she beat that day is going to produce one a bit faster about 20 years later. Late 98, 99, that I decided to go it alone with Bill, and that was very amicable. I gave him 6 months' notice, and he really appreciated that, and we gave the clients the option of whether they left horses with me or gave them to Bill, and we were very supportive in their decisions in doing that. And I was fortunate enough when I kicked off, I probably kicked off with 40 or 50 horses in Brisbane, and I really enjoyed it and loved it. But Queensland racing, unfortunately, seems to be shrouded in controversy, and governments and elections have never had the backing, a strong backing of strong racing, you know, not since the days of Russ Hinds and all that. When I was a kid, the racing ministers and that, like you see in New South Wales and Victoria to this day, you seem to have strong governance and racing going ahead. But Queensland, you'd have these flash-in-the-pan things, and you've got great carnivals, a winter carnival, and now the Magic Millions carnival. But the day-to-day running of racing, and probably in fairness, it's such a vast state compared to the likes of Victoria, you know, it was just hard to make a living. You know, I'd find myself paying the wages on Friday and having to snip the staff as they walked out the back gate, and that was after I trained 8 or 10 winners for the week.
Yeah, so imagine how the others were going.
So, yeah, exactly. So I quickly realised, and I had the support of my wife, Sarah, and we had a very young family then. We had three girls under two, that for us to have a future, it was going to be in Victoria, and it was very timely that Jim Conlon, who used to stay with me during the Northern Carnivals, he knew of my desire to come to Victoria and train, and that opportunity to open that satellite stable at Caulfield. And I was very selective in the horses, and I had the backing of my clients and what horses we came down here. And ultimately, one of those was Amalfi. You know, he won the Norman Robinson, then won the Derby. But I won quite a few other little stakes races around the place for some very influential breeders in the Hunter Valley, and namely the Esplin family. Philip Esplin, he was one of the original directors of Arrowfield Stud, and then his own farm in Twin Palms Stud, and Stuart and Trish Ramsey, Taronga Farms. They were very good supporters of mine, and I had success for them, which was most important because they were my main backers, and that, you know, word of mouth spreads, and then I had other people on board. And I think it was about 2003, we decided that we would close the Queensland operation and put all our eggs into one basket in Victoria. And I commuted for about 18 months between Brisbane and Melbourne. And it's funny, I used to be able to watch the horses gallop. You know, I used to do my gallops here on a Monday morning and then fly back to Brisbane and do them on a Tuesday morning. But I found in the summer months, with the daylight savings, I could quite often get home in time to Eagle Farm by 8:30 in the morning or 7:30 in the morning and watch the barrier trials because of the time change and things like that. So it was very stressful, and I was lucky I had the support of good clients and a strong woman at home to get me through that. So 2003, full-time in Victoria, and I think we won our second Group 1 then. Might have been
Ancient Songs?
Ancient Song might have won a Salinger or somewhere around there, and the ball started rolling. And I think about 2004-05, I won the Victorian Country Premiership. And for me, in those early days in Queensland, travelling vast distances, it was great education, because not suggesting that I was a forerunner or anything, but it's funny, you know, self-praise is worth 5 ages stuff all. But when I first came down here, when I had those horses that weren't good enough to be winning in town, it was a very good learning curve for me, because I used to take a truckload to Donald or Swan Hill or Echuca or Bairnsdale, places I'd never heard of, Stony Creek, And it was a good learning curve for me because I taught average horses how to win by placing them correctly. And then realised that these average horses could knock off the blue bloods because they were 6 foot tall and bulletproof. And, you know, I used to stand in the Caulfield trainers tower every morning. The boys used to take the piss out of me. And blokes I had great respect for, Freedy and Colin Little and, you know, different blokes there over the years. And, you know, where you going today, Moods? You know, I'd be going to some far-flung track. And my truck would be the only one in the car park. Well, you go to those far-flung tracks now, you're lucky to get a slot in the car park, you know. And with those wins, I attracted Victorian clients, and the quality of my stable grew and developed. And I think right through to we won our first premiership and metropolitan premiership. I won a couple of country ones, and then a young bloke, not much younger than me, only a few years younger than me, came along called DK Weir, and he started cleaning up everywhere in the country. And I was fortunate enough that I think I won three or four metropolitan.
Three
metropolitan premierships. Up to 2009, and we were getting sort of probably a Group 1 winner every year or two. And, you know, then the history books will say along came the greatest of them all, and for me. And I pinch myself every day that I was able to play a small part in her life. And, of course, we talk about Black Caviar.
Yeah, and we'll devote a break to her because I think we have to. But a couple of horses just before we go to the break. Typhoon Tracy. Did you ever have one that tried harder than she did?
She was a bonny mare. God, she was such a thing as a beautiful, you know, she was one of the few top line fillies and mares that I've ever seen that kept her femininity, if that makes sense. Mm. Probably a little bit winxish, but she's probably a little bit stronger, but not the bone and muscle of a Mackaybe or a Sunline or a Black Caviar. She was just a queen. She was a princess, Black Caviar. And I've got no doubt in the world it's due to her that Black Caviar ended up being as good as she became. Because when I had issues with Black Caviar in the early days and probably could have been forced to push the envelope with her and maybe hurt her, I could walk out the back and pat Typhoon Tracy, who I knew was going to pay the wages, keep the fridge full, and be going around in five or six Group 1s that year. And for any trainer, that was an unbelievable thing to be able to do. And I had a lot of other good horses at the time, and that enabled me to give this unbelievable, promising young star who had issues, namely Black Caviar, the time that she required. Just a beautiful mare. And it was one of the few times I've probably cried over a horse when I think it was Peter Orton from Vinery Stud rang me the morning and told me she died foaling, having her only foal. And it was a very sad moment. And, you know, to retire her at the top of a game, I retired her. Well, I think we can touch it all over. But one of the greatest things for my career, I think, ever is, and like I say, self-praise, 5/8 of stuff all, is the three best horses I trained, being Typhoon Tracy, Black Caviar and Dissident, all Australian Horse of the Years, all retired off the back of Wait for Age Group 1 wins.
Yeah.
So that was very important for me to see them go out where they belong. But she was a princess, Typhoon Tracy.
Can I ask you about one other horse, and one race in particular? You trained Wanted to win the Newmarket.
Yeah.
That was one of the most bizarre days that I have ever had at the races.
It was unbelievable, wasn't it? Funny thing, long story short, so I know we've got a time frame here, Wanted won that race in the massive hailstorm. I rang my wife, Sarah, at home, and I said, "Hun," and we live at South Belgrave, we've got a farm there. I said, "I'm not sure if this storm's coming your way, but should just grab those couple of mares behind the house paddock and bring them into the barn just in case." A couple of mares who used to spell together, Typhoon Tracy and Black Caviar.
Wow.
I said, "You should just probably grab them and drag them into the barn." She rang me back about an hour later. And she said, "You wouldn't believe it. I just got them in under the roller door and it bloody hit." And we were building a new house at the time and it destroyed the roof on the new house. But the barn withstood everything. And there's probably the two most valuable mares in Australia that were in a paddock together. Listen, I think they would have been sensible enough to take cover, but you don't know. But that day, Wanted winning that Newmarket, that was phenomenal. That was eerie, wasn't it? Like, it came from nowhere. And the way the horses veed and people had all these theories that, you know, did he win it because of he's the best horse, or they have this herd thing, but he was a good, tough, bloody sprinter, and you know, he ran Black Caviar to a neck there one day in the Dane Hill Stakes.
I remember two things about that day. I remember that it was green when the race was run. Yeah. It was just the most eerie light. And the other thing I remember is that Wanted got away from the strapper after the race and went herring down the tunnel because of the conditions that were going on. And John Patterson, the clerk of the course, turned his pony.
And blocked him.
And blocked him.
Yeah.
And put his life on the line.
Well, he was probably very fortunate where my strapper that day kept him in the enclosure where everyone else had bolted. And thankfully the tunnel was empty except for Pato.
Yeah.
And what a great horseman he is.
We are just about out of time, but I've got one more segment that we are going to devote to the great mare. And we're going to talk about a couple of the wins, but just in general what it's like to be associated with a sporting phenomenon like Black Caviar. We'll do that with Peter Moody on the other side of the break on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Peter Moody is my guest on This Is Your Sporting Life. Pete, Black Caviar, it was obviously a privilege to train her. Was it a curse in some ways as well because you became the face of racing? You went to the races every time with her, with people expecting that you just had to turn up to win. Did it put a lot of pressure on you at that time? Did you enjoy the ride totally or was it tough at times?
It wasn't until the day I retired her that I really then realised how much pressure it did apply to me. It was like the weight of a building being lifted off your shoulders. It was phenomenal. I thought I handled it pretty well, but that's for other people to judge. The pressures external to racing were the hard parts. You know, she became the biggest show, nearly the biggest sporting show in Australia in respect to her. Like, and the people removed from racing that didn't understand it. You know, I had prime ministers wanting her to go up to Canberra so the Queen could meet her. I had the Queen wanting to meet her in Melbourne. This is Queen Elizabeth wanted to come and visit her, and they ended up getting her to go on an old wooden tram that restored rather than that. You know, I joked with Archie Thompson the other night. Moomba wanted her to be Queen of Moomba. They wanted her in an AFL grand final. That was probably greater pressure than actually getting her to the races. The other pressure, and any coach or whatever, and Chris Waller and Hugh Bowman would be certainly feeling this at the moment, is we love our champions in Australia, but we're soon quick to jump up and down on their heads if something goes wrong. And I knew if she ever got beat, along with Luke Nolan, that we were the two that were going to get kicked to death if she ever got beat after that record. So I had to be mindful of that, the pressure of going to the races and knowing the only way she was ever going to get beat. The facts and figures supported this was if something went wrong.
Mm.
And regardless if that was misadventure or greed on my behalf, I was going to get kicked to death for it. So that was enormous pressure, and it was unusual to have to the winning a race was about relief, not enjoyment and celebration. It was enjoyment and celebration for the other connections and for the people around her. But for Luke and I, you'd go home totally exhausted. Now, I pinch myself every day that I've had the opportunity to train one of our greatest horses. I'm never going to say she was the greatest, but to me, she always will be. You can put the records of all the great champions of Australian racing around the wall there, and the one uniqueness that she will always have and will never be probably equaled, she's the only one undefeated. So that's something pretty special. But for Luke and I, it was sad that it was more about relief than enjoyment.
Mm.
But when the day we retired, we were then able to enjoy it. And I've actually had this conversation with Chris Waller. I reckon you'll get more enjoyment out of Winx's career the day you retire, and you can sit back and reflect on it without that pressure. But she was a phenomenal athlete, power, strength, like the great J.B. Cummings, the neck of a duchess and the arse of a cook. And she was just a powerhouse. She had unbelievable ability. But like all great champions, she had that raw ability as an early horse. Thankfully, as she matured, both physically and mentally, she was able to harness it and use it in a positive way. And we've all seen brilliant young animals, equines, or sports people, all the ability in the world. Like every great champion will say they've played with someone 20 years ago or saw someone 10 years ago that was just as good, if not better, but their path didn't go the right way. Thankfully, she harnessed all that brute energy and I was able to manage it and push it in the right direction, because I would say as a two-year-old, I probably had other two-year-olds with just as much ability, but they never went on and they never improved with that mental capability or physically as she did.
I remember the day she won the TJ and I had to speak to you in the mounting yard there, and remember there were a couple of things went wrong with the camera and we did an interview and I had to come to you and say, Pete, can we do it again? You fulfilled it because I think you felt part of what was going on. It was one of the more extraordinary days. The emotion on a race course that day could hardly be replicated.
That's at her last run?
Yeah.
No, well, I was starting to think it was very close to the end. I didn't know it for sure on that day, but maybe in the back of my head I did realise that. But that night, it was just on dusk, and you'd remember it was the last race.
Yeah.
I'm not into the horse whispering stuff. I think people have a great understanding. But I reckon she looked at me in the enclosure. Donna and Paddy Bell and Tony Hayden, my right-hand man, they were all there as the people were getting photos. And I reckon she looked over to me and said, hey, Moods, I'm rooted. I've had enough.
Yeah.
And it probably took 72 hours for me to really gather that in and call the owners together. And they thought I was calling them together to maybe discuss another overseas trip. They said, I pointed out all her ailments. They said, what do you want to do with her? I said, 25 is a great number. I think we should retire. And there wasn't one dry eye in the house, but there wasn't one suggestion that we should do anything else.
We're just about out of time again, so I'm going to take our final break and then some final thoughts with Peter Moody on the other side of the break. This is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
How lucky have we been to live in an era where we've seen Maccabi Diva, Winx and your mare Black Caviar all in one lifetime, all mares, all champions.
You know, you might have to wait another 100 years to see it. It's been a great time for racing, so let's celebrate these great champions.
And we celebrate your part in racing as well. You've been a big part of it, and what you did with Black Caviar will never be forgotten by a lot of people, me included. We wish you the best in this fledgling career. You'll be taking over my job. You'll have your own interview program probably next week or the week after. But everything seems to be going really well. Thanks for coming in and sharing some of your stories with us.
Thanks for the opportunity to have a chat, mate. Really appreciate it. And good luck, good punting. Not a bad trainer, not a bad bloke. That's the last two lines of my book.
Good on you, mate. Peter Moody joining us on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. And we'll be back with another edition of the program same time next week. Hope you can join us then.